Maine's centenarians, what it takes to live for a century. Perhaps you've heard them. I hope so. The series of stories over the past couple weeks here on Maine Public Radio about centenarians in Maine, people who live to 100. The profiles are part of a partnership with Down East Magazine as the state celebrates its 200th birthday. There is a lot we can learn from centenarians, from their own advice, and from researchers who study people who live exceptionally long lives. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Living to 100. Right now, about 1 in 6,000 Americans is expected to live for a full century, but that percentage is predicted to rise. The United Nations estimates that by the year 2050, there will be 3.7 million centenarians across the globe. Do you know someone who is 100? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What does it mean to live to be 100? As part of Maine Public Radio's recent series on centenarians, we are exploring the topic further on today's show. What do we know about living to an advanced age? Joining me in the studio, Marilyn Gallucci. She is professor and director of geriatrics, education, and research, as well as director of the fitness and wellness program for older adults within the University of New England's College of Osteopathic Medicine Division of Geriatrics. And Tom Muser is the director for the Center for Excellence in Aging and Health and professor of social work at the University of New England. To learn more about the series on Maine Centenarians, which is a collaboration with Down East Magazine, you can go to mainepublic.org/century. And we are also going to be re-airing several of the profiles from the series to Tuesday and Wednesday on the program Here and Now. So as always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a friend or relative who is 100 or getting close? What are the biggest challenges people face when they reach such an advanced age? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or give us a call, as always, at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. And before we talk with our panelists, we want to turn to our own Maine Public reporter, Patty White, who's here in the studio. She's one of the reporters who told the stories of Maine centenarians over the past couple weeks. Thanks for joining us, Patty.
Great to be here.
You spoke with a couple of centenarians for this series. What struck you about the people you met?
I think the thing that struck me the most, all three of the centenarians I interviewed were still living at home, still very content. And I think one of the big reasons for that, I mean, they were lucky that they didn't have any serious illness, but they all had strong support from their family or neighbors or community or all of the above, which I think played a big role in them, you know, being able to be at home, be content, and maybe even living to 100.
So people were coming into their homes very regularly, bringing them food and doing other things for them?
Yeah. Well, in the instance of Dan Donnell, who I think we'll hear a clip from him, but, you know, he still lives independently. The other people I interviewed lived with family members, either a spouse or a child. An adult child, obviously. But Dan Donnell, he lives independently, but he has neighbors who stop in every week to play cribbage, who bring him a big crock pot of food every week that serves as his dinners. And I think it was a good reminder that some of those acts that seem kind of small make a big difference, you know, as a neighbor.
You did mention we're going to listen to a little bit of your interview with Dan Donnell.
For me, it's been really fantastic, and I'm sure it's added 5 or 6 years to my life, really.
Why is that?
You stay home. You get stiff pretty quick, and you don't meet a soul. And if you get out and volunteer, you're helping somebody, and you are really helping yourself more than anything. It's absolutely amazing to be able to do it.
And I should clarify that Stan Donnell talking about volunteering. He's 100 years old, and he volunteers. Patty, he said it himself, he attributes that to his well-being.
That's right, yeah. So he started volunteering when he was 85, after his wife passed away, and he said he realized he needed to get out and do something, and he decided to go to York Hospital. That's actually where he was born.
Wow.
He escorts patients to whatever rooms they need to go to, and he's had to cut back. He used to do it 2 days a week, but he now does it 1 day a week. But that's another support network. He did say in our interview, you know, if I feel like if I needed anything, I could tell people at the hospital and they would help me out.
You also interviewed Ruth Endicott, who passed away since you spoke with her. Talk about what stuck with you as you think about your interview with Ruth.
Well, so she lived with her daughter. It seemed like they had a really wonderful relationship, and Ruth herself had a very remarkable life. I mean, she grew up on a farm in Belgrade. Her family, as I understand it, they couldn't afford to send her to college, so she worked at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, picked up a hobby of flying, which at the time, of course, was very unusual for a woman. Then when the U.S. joined World War II, she joined the Army Women's Corps, worked in London as a court stenographer, came back home, went to Colby College, got a degree in chemistry, then became a physician, which again, at the time, was not common, got married at age 40 and had kids, also not typical. And another interesting thing is that she had she operated a family practice, family physician practice out of her house in Ogunquit, and she retired at age 89, so about 15 years ago.
Wow. Well, Patty, thanks so much for joining us and great work on the series. We're going to hear from Robbie Feinberg and Susan Sharon a little bit later in this program. I appreciate you taking the time to come in here. And I want to talk with both of you, Tom and Marilyn, about some of the things Patty said about the people that she met. No serious illness, 40 years old and older when she had kids, and just keeping her her mind alive, Ruth Endicott, plus the volunteering that we heard about with Dan. Marilyn, when you hear these two stories, are they representative of the kind of people who live to a very old age?
Well, I think there's no question that attitude plays a big role. And the other piece is purpose in life. There's actually research about that, that people who feel they have a sense of purpose certainly have reasons to embrace life and move through life. So attitude and purpose and that support system, those are key factors for aging in general. And I think you have to get into some genetics when you're getting into the centenarians as well.
Sure, the centenarians, the super agers. So we were talking about what are the best terms for people in this age group, Tom. You can't really say extreme aging, even though we use the phrase extreme for everything else in our lives. How do you refer to the people who've lived a really long time?
Well, we tend to break down the age range from maybe the young old, the old, and the old old or oldest old. And it really is an artificial way of thinking about aging. It's a continuum, and we all age in different ways and with different trajectories. I think why centenarians are so interesting to us is because of that three-digit number. And there aren't many new milestones toward the end of our lifespan prior to death. And reaching this three-level number, I think, means something and is representative of what's possible for other people. It also, I think, challenges perceptions that we may have about aging that may be negative, to think in terms of, wow, that's possible to volunteer. It's possible to be still an active physician near 100.
Yeah, I was really interested to read the New England Centenarian Study. Mm-hmm. Marilyn, and I know you're familiar with this, that 15% of centenarians that were studied had no clinically demonstrable disease age. People they call
escapers.
I mean, astonishing. You know, we think about a lot of things that happen as we age as inevitable. And some of these people say that that's not quite the case.
No, I think we're really at the point where we're trying to move beyond that aging myth that the older you get, the sicker you get. That's no longer true. The truth of the matter is the older you get, the healthier you get. And for the escapers, you know, that 15% that are not showing any kind of disease into their later years is just remarkable. But they also have, which you're probably familiar with, Jennifer, the other two groups, part of the centenarian study, which are the delayers,
right,
and the survivors. And the delayers, actually, is about 40%+ that really manage to dodge, if you will, disease until they're into their later 80s or mid to later 80s. And the survivors are one who maybe have had disease but then continue to move on.
Now, this New England study that we've been talking about has been going on for a long time now. But, Tom, I understand you've launched a study of your own. Tell me about it.
Well, at our Center for Excellence in Aging and Health, we're interested in inviting adults of all ages, but particularly the second half of life, to join with us to understand what is healthy aging across that broad span from retirement until death. We have over 400 Southern Mainers enrolled in our Legacy Scholars Program, which involves providing some information about themselves in terms of research, but it's also a lifelong learning kind of club. We get together for coffee. We talk about challenging topics. In fact, our next coffee will focus on medical marijuana and its benefits, which should be really interesting.
Mm. If you'd like to talk about living to 100, someone you know, or maybe you have lived that long, give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I read, Marilyn, that anybody born past the year 2000 can expect to live to 100. Is that true?
Well, I think that's hard to say, but I've also heard, Jennifer, that there is somebody living right now who will live to the age of 150. Well, that sounds pretty remarkable to me. But I think with the way things are going and a better diet, I'm not sure if our healthcare system is actually part of all that, to be quite honest. But as we're moving towards the age-friendly health system, where we're looking at, for older adults, what matters most to them. It's the four M's: matters most, medications, mentation, cognitive kinds of things, and the mobilization, the physical function. As we're focusing on that more with older adults, I think we can certainly expect to have our older adults live longer. I mean, the data is showing that.
And to put this in some perspective, over the course of the 20th century, the average lifespan increased by 30 years, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've increased by generations since early on. So this is something that the expectation for us to live longer lives, to have the 85-plus-year-old grow by hundreds of percentage points is something that we're expecting. Now, of course, socioeconomics get into that, and you know.
Well, that was interesting, and I was going to bring that up with you all. And Tom, I read that the centenarians come from every level of the socioeconomic ladder, every region of the world. There used to be this thought that people in different parts of the world had an advantage, and that's kind of been debunked, right?
To some extent. I mean, we call these areas blue zones, where there is a climate, there is a sense of community, where there is a common diet and other factors that will support good longevity. And I think it's more possible today, in part because of the support structures that exist in many different communities. We heard in the two stories presented so far of Don and Ruth, neither of them were doing this alone. There was a support network, whether informal or formal, allowing them to be engaged, even with some illness, as they've gotten older. So I think it's possible anywhere, but it's particularly possible where there's a strong community support network.
Mm. Well, I'm going to go to Ava, who's calling from York. Ava, hi. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I find this topic fascinating. I'll just preface it with when I was in college, we were the first graduating class with a major of gerontology. It didn't exist really prior. I worked as an internship and did oral histories of residents. Mm-hmm. In my own family, my two grandfathers lived till 95 and 96, living at home. Although I always say that's why they invented Florida for people from northern New England, because they were cocooned in a nice, safe, warm environment in the winter. And so I was just, well, first of all, the other thing I want to say is I kayak and often wave to Dan Donnell, who has a lovely little perch up in York Harbor, to see just a wonderful view of everything that's going on in the harbor. And he's just such an upbeat fellow, always a positive attitude. He actually reminds me of my grandfather. And his interview was lovely on your show, but it's all real. That's the way he is.
Well, Ava, thank you so much for calling. You know, Marilyn, talking about attitude is one of the many ingredients here to living a long time. But I want to talk to you all about something else Ava said. Both of her grandfathers lived into their 90s. That's unusual, right? Most of the people who live into their 90s or to 100 are women. Why is that?
Well, part of it is that, and they found this in the centenarian study, actually, is that around 1910, 1920, which is that cohort that's coming through now, that their lifestyle was very different. So a lot of times there were smokers, poor diet, blue-collar work, things that would actually put people at risk for not living a long life. But then, you know, I feel that making these blanket statements just doesn't work. Madame Calmette, who died at the age of 122, smoked until the age of 117. And the only reason why she stopped was because she went blind and she didn't want to ask for help. So, you know, is it smoking? Of course, that's going to increase risks. But again, I think we're back to that genetics, that attitude, the diet. And exercise is extremely important.
Sure, though, but Tom, 85% of centenarians are women.
Yes.
85%. That's more than coincidence.
Hardy. We're just hardy.
You know, I think this is something that is partly luck of the draw. And I think what Marilyn suggested with respect to lifestyle makes a big difference. You know, if you are a traditional male breadwinner type person, and perhaps you think about like the 60s Mad Men culture of the heavy drinking, the heavy smoking, a lot of your longevity is really based on what happens at midlife. So your weight at midlife is predictive of your health later. And a lot of those midlife behaviors make a big difference. So are men more likely to take risks? Some would argue they are. Certainly in terms of being drivers or safe drivers, that's an issue. I don't have a perfect answer for that because in many ways, each person is an experiment in and of him or herself.
All right. I'm reading here from the New England Centenarian Study and so many factors. Not anyone, like you said, even though smoking is indeed not smoking is indeed on the list. One preliminary study suggests centenarians are better able to handle stress than the majority of people. Many women have had a history of bearing children after the age of 35 or even 40. And I thought this was interesting. Compared to population norms, they score low in neuroticism and high in extroversion. Sounds like that's what we were hearing about Dan Donnell, that he's very extroverted.
And if I can say a little more about Madame Calmette, who lived to 122, her famous quote was, "I only have one wrinkle and I'm sitting on it." I mean, what this woman was known for was her unflappability. And she rode her bike into her hundreds. She finally went to a nursing home about 110. But she really embraced, without any family, she embraced the community in Arles, France, where she lived. She made it a point to go around and see every person that went to her 100th birthday party. She did similar things when she was 120 at her birthday party there. So I think that as an extrovert, I like the idea that being extroverted is something that's going to help your longevity. But that unflappability, that key point in terms of her personality seemed to really ring true. She also ate 2 pounds of chocolate a week and put olive oil on her face. And she said those were the reasons why she was able to live, those 3 points.
Well, and, you know, I think another piece of this, I mean, Marilyn mentioned attitude before. So there is also the Georgia Centenarian Study. And they found that those that lived successfully into the 90s and 100s had positive self-perceptions of health, whether their objective health was bad or not. If you believed yourself well, that was a strong predictor of how well you would do. So much of it is your own will.
Interesting. We are going to take a quick break. We're talking about living to 100. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
An entrepreneur thought she had found an investor who was keen on her business. Then he tried to use a promise of funding to extract sexual favors from her.
I just thought, is this what I'm going to have to subject myself to if I want to raise this money and build our dream?
How she responded and the latest in the confrontation between the U.S. and Iran this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio.
This week on Maine's Political Pulse.
That seems an odd way to operate.
Maine Senator Susan Collins chastises Republicans and Democrats over impeachment, but what role will she play in shaping the trial? Join me, Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler, and Senior Correspondent Mal Leary from Maine's Political Pulse, available online by Friday afternoons, also on the air Sunday during the 10 o'clock hour of Weekend Edition and during Monday's Morning Edition. Maine's Political Pulse, available anytime at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what it means to live to 100. My guests are Tom Muser, who is director of the Center for Excellence in Aging and Health at the University of New England, and Marilyn Gallucci, who is a professor and director of geriatrics education and research with the UNE College of Osteopathic Medicine. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And now with us, Maine Public's Deputy News Director, Susan Sharon. You may have heard her interview with the Three Dots, three centenarians all named Dorothy who have known each other since childhood. Thanks for being here, Susan. And we're going to listen to one of the Dots now. Here's Dorothy Buchanan speaking about living 100 years.
What's the best part of being 100? Is there a best part?
That I'm still here, I guess. I don't really have any pluses. I think everybody, you girls included, I think you said, would I like to be 100? And I think you'd probably say no. I don't want to be 100.
Because it's lonely.
Yeah, I don't drive. I always drove and loved driving. You're no longer an individual. You can't get in your car and go to the grocery store. So that's what I miss.
You miss your freedom.
Yes.
You miss your freedom and your freedom to do what you choose.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's probably what I miss an awful lot.
Do you get out of the house very much, Doc?
No. It's getting the point where I get out and it's hard to get in the car and it's hard to get out of the car. And then you have to take your cane and you have to take your walker. It's hard to get in the store. Why bother?
Susan, talk about this idea that it's not necessarily all positive to be able to live to 100.
Right. Well, first I should say about Dorothy Buchanan is that all the Three Dots just have the most amazing spirits, and they are very positive. But the reality is that I think that we have this idea that getting to be 100 years old is such this amazing milestone, and it's something you sort of think about. Oh, would it be so great to live that long? But there are these challenges and difficulties, and which Dorothy Buchanan touches on, and which all the Three Dots said, which is giving up driving was a huge thing. One of them still drives. Dorothy Murray is still driving at 100. They teased her about that. They're all friends, but giving up driving is a huge one. And two of the Dots have walkers, so it's difficult for them. They're living in their houses. All three of them are living in the houses that they were raised in as children and raised their own children in and now live in after their children have grown up. But they can't leave the house easily. It's hard to get in and out of the car, as Dorothy Buchanan said. There is some loneliness because they've outlived their spouses. They've outlived their siblings. They've outlived most of their friends. Their friends are younger. And even in a couple of cases, outlived some children.
Sure.
So it's that is difficult, and it's not the part we often focus on.
Anything else that stood out for you from the interviews?
I think Patty touched on this before, which is just how amazing their relationships with their families are. Their children are just so loving and so supportive and very protective. And, you know, even Dorothy Buchanan, when one of her oldest daughter came during the interview and she just stopped the interview and said, this is my oldest daughter. See how beautiful she is. They're just so proud of their families. And they've all been very social, as I think you've been discussing on the program. Very social. They planned a lot of things. They love to be outside. They love to be with their friends. So definitely the positive attitude and being active and being engaged is what is it. And they still have, and they're still in their homes. They still enjoy reading and music and, you know, having people come over.
Well, Susan, thanks so much for coming in. That's Susan Sharon, Maine Public's Deputy News Director. Tom, what Susan says that, you know, making it to 100 isn't necessarily all that we might think it is. You're nodding. You were nodding the entire time she was saying that. What do we find? What are people not just physically unable to get around, but as easily as they used to? But what are some of the other problems with being that old?
Well, you think about how we define ourselves in our society. We often define ourselves by our roles within our families, but also particularly by our careers and what we contribute. And even though there are these super agers, as Marilyn suggested, maybe 15% that are 100 and very functional and maybe have avoided disease, that the other 85% haven't or have more challenges. And I think that's part of what we were just hearing there, is that there's a reality of loss. And it's multiple losses. And one of the other things that the Georgia Centenarian study suggested was adaptability is also a predictor. So the ability to kind of roll with it and accept what you have now. So glasses half full versus maybe glasses half empty.
Mm. Joining us now, Maine Public reporter Robbie Feinberg. You also had the chance to interview some centenarians and headed all the way up into Aroostook County, right in the crown of Maine, right, Robbie?
Right in Fort Kent.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So we're going to start by listening to one of your interviews. This is Alfreda Dumond.
I have a nice memories, and I still got it, those memories, good memories. I don't look at whatever gone by that wasn't good. But telling you the truth, I always been a happy person. I love the world. I love to live. I love to, you know, and I still do.
I think we're picking up a theme here. Robbie, what did you learn about Alfreda Dumond?
Yeah, I think Alfreda, I mean, her whole life is exactly what your guests were just touching on there, where she is someone who she grew up in Fort Kent on this farm, very kind of, you know, rural living, moved to Connecticut during the Great Depression, basically really had to be adaptable and resilient that way. And then in her 20s, she almost passed away at that point. She got a lesion on her lung and was sent for 3 years to a sanitarium in Presque Isle. And she was so ill at points that actually her children, and she herself talks about, she never expected that she would have become 100 years old. But after that illness happened for her and she did recover, she talked about just how her mindset and perspective completely changed. It turned her into this optimist who, as you just heard there, just always thought about the future and just kind of trying to embrace every next memory and, you know, time with her kids because, you know, she almost didn't have that.
The gift of perspective, it sounds like, is very powerful. Robbie, as you think back on your interviews, what are you thinking about? What's staying with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a lot of it, the perspective from so many of these people, and especially from the centenarians who I talked with at this nursing home in Fort Kent, where they were all, I mean, some of them I talked to, they grew up, I mean, they got married and they didn't have electricity in their houses. So they just, you know, they offer such a perspective. I'm almost 28 and I think I have that kind of perspective, and I obviously don't at all. I mean, just talking
to
them.
You don't remember a time without electricity?
Oh, no, not at all. So it was, yeah, it was wonderful to just get that kind of perspective, but also the resilience from so many of these people was what I heard so much about. And from one woman who, I mean, one woman got married at 15, another was sent off to a logging camp at age 15. I mean, they just went through so much, and you just hear about how that influenced them today and how that really has changed their perspective.
Oh, well, Robbie, thanks so much for coming in here. That's Maine Public reporter Robbie Feinberg. I'm going to go now to Jenny, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Jenny. Go ahead.
Hi. I have an African-American great-grandmother, and she is 104, turning 105 in April. And she is just one of the sharpest people I know. And she has often said the same thing, which is that she enjoys life. And that is one of, I believe that's one of the reasons she's so long lasting. But as you guys had said earlier, she has already outlived two out of three of her sons. And, you know, we're all aware of how much that breaks her heart. But she continues to just be one of the most extroverted people. She travels for conventions all across the United States multiple times a year at 104 years old.
What kind of conventions?
She's a member of the Elks. And so she travels with, you know, companions. Her young companions are all in their 80s. And they all travel together. I mean, she lives in California. And the last time I saw her, I had traveled to Baltimore to meet her at one of the conventions. And she'd been a member of the Elks her whole life. And so she's just, you know, one of the most lively people I know, with an amazing history. She actually had a PBS like mini documentary made about a town that she grew up in, and she's one of the only people living in the town, so it actually heavily features her.
Oh, wow. Well, Jenny, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your story about your grandmother flying cross-country at Post 100. What do you all hear in Jenny's story?
Well, what I'm struck by in this is that, you know, they always say if you've met one older adult, you've met one older adult. And but there's a colleague of ours, Bob Atchley, who actually reformulated this continuity theory that there's this red thread that runs through your life, that who you were when you were younger is who you will be when you are older. But the fact of the matter is, and what Dr. Atchley proved, was that we're dynamic beings, and we have the ability to change. And, you know, I heard Robbie say with Alfreda that she had this disease. She's one of the survivors, right, that would be in the centenarian study. And her attitude changed after that. And in some ways, people might call that a significant emotional experience, a C. But the truth of the matter is, because we are dynamic, because we are human, we can all embrace that positive way of looking at the world. I mean, we get to choose. Do we want to deal with the situation as negative, or do we want to deal with it as a positive? And the human brain can only think one thought at a time. So are you going to choose the positive thoughts, or are you going to choose the negative thoughts? And it's really kind of an interesting choice, if you will, but it really takes a lot of inner resilience. And that was the word Robbie used as well. I think that resilience, that attitude, that purpose, all of that comes together along with genetics to really make a difference.
Jenny, thanks so much for your call. A tweet from Catherine. Catherine tweets, seems aging in place contributes to living to 100. Are people more likely to reach 100 if they stay at home or in nursing homes? Well, we've heard both. The folks Robbie was talking about live in the same nursing home in Fort Kent. But the other reporters have met people. Susan Sharon, said the three dots all live in the house they grew up in. So are there any kind of statistics that show one being preferable to the other in terms of longevity?
You know, we make home in many different places. I think there's certainly a romanticism to aging in place, particularly within a historic family home or setting. Much depends, I think, though, on the support network, as we spoke earlier, that surrounds you in that place. And it's more of a dynamic thing. But I think sense of place matters in terms of meaning and in terms of feeling that you still have a purpose in life. When you're disconnected and suddenly maybe a crisis happens and your kids put you in a nursing home, I think that's when we're most at risk in terms of our longevity, because of that disconnection from what matters to us.
Mm. We'll go to Margie, who's calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Margie.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to tell you, I don't think you know, but I'm 88. I'm in my 88th year. And I was born on Thanksgiving Day. I'm not a turkey. They gave thanks when I was born. But you know what? I cook from scratch. I split wood. I take a walk. I don't take any pharmaceuticals. I take vitamins when I need them, and I obey my body. My body says I'm tired, I sit down. And I obey my body, number one. And I also go to the nursing home to visit all the older people, ha-ha. and make them laugh on Halloween. I dress up on Halloween. So you know what? Laughter is the best medicine, and music, and eat good, and just wish everybody that you know health and happiness. That's all I want to say.
Margie, thanks so much for calling, and we did not know your age, and we so appreciate you being a regular listener to Maine Calling. What about Margie's formula for living a long time?
Sounds attractive to me, I'll tell you.
Absolutely. I totally agree with it. And I think the part that really came through for me with Margie is how much she wants to engage with other people and help change their lives as well for the better. And that's a gift that we all should be giving to each other.
You know, we often think about older adults as recipients of care, and yet it's the providing of care to others. Even if you need some help yourself, doesn't mean you can't provide help to others. And I think that's the engagement that really matters.
Margie, thanks so much for calling. We do need to take another quick break. If you want to join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. If you want to send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, please do it quickly. We're talking about living to be 100. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com. The University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu. And Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with Anti-Cemex Smart Pest Control technology. ModernPest.com.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 6, 1953, Nathaniel Haskell, a native of Pittsfield, was governor of Maine for exactly 25 hours. Haskell's brief term was the result of constitutional succession in the wake of the 1952 elections. The outgoing governor, Frederick Payne, resigned early to begin preparing to take his new seat in the U.S. Senate. With Maine having no lieutenant governor, the president of the Senate, Haskell's position at the time, was next in the line of succession.
Visit MainePublic.org to explore all the ways that Maine Public is celebrating Maine's bicentennial. Happy birthday, Maine!
On the next Speaking in Maine, Arctic climate change and Maine.
Climate change is such an unbelievably multi and interdisciplinary undertaking. It impacts every single thing that we do.
Dr. Paul Mayuski is director of the Climate Change Institute and distinguished professor at University of Maine, Orono. He spoke at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland about the devastating effects of Arctic climate change. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Monday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the challenge and joys of living a long life. My guests are Marilyn Gallucci and Tom Muser, who are both focusing on aging with the University of New England. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. One more bit of sound from one of the centenarians interviewed in the last couple weeks here on Maine Public Radio.
Why do you think you've lived so long? What do you attribute it to?
Peanut butter. I always say that. I've always had it. I love it. And what else can you say when people say, how come you live so late? Well, I want to treat it lightly. Peanut butter.
That is Susan Sharon talking with Dorothy Kern. She says people always ask her what the secret is, so that's wonderful. But she does talk about peanut butter. Is there any evidence that what we eat contributes to a super long life?
Well, we think about what's healthy for the heart is healthy for the brain, and so the Mediterranean diet is one that we would recommend for any age. I think sure it matters, and yet there are always going to be the outliers. My own grandmother was a heavy smoker and made it to 90 despite that. So there's the common pathway of taking care of oneself and eating well, but there's always going to be an outlier.
We'll go to Steve, who's calling from Naples. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. I
it should be mentioned more often that the most important part of your life is your mind, your intellect, our brain. Too many elderly people don't seem to have enough interest. They don't read enough. They don't have enough interest. Do they have a library card? I wonder. But that's an important thing. A positive attitude also, of course, is important. But being interested, the world is a fascinating place. And you must, whatever your interests may be, follow them. Use it. Don't just ignore it. You have to be fortunate also, of course, to be fairly healthy. That's a positive, and hopefully for most people it works pretty well.
Steve, I'm going to ask you a question that I would not ask a caller on any other program. How old are you?
I'm 90 years old.
Congratulations. Marilyn is smiling as you are talking.
And Steve, I'm wondering, have you gotten into using the internet and computers? Is that part of how
no,
you...
No, I've thought of getting a computer, but all these years, I just haven't done it. I just decided it would probably interfere with my reading anyway.
Ah, good.
It would be nice to have, I think. Maybe one day I will if I live long enough. Who knows?
I was actually curious about the centenarians that were interviewed for this show. And for those that may be homebound or in a nursing home, the ability to do virtual travel, to work with computers, to expand and explore the world from sitting in front of a computer is really a viable option.
But what about Steve's point that you've got to be intellectually stimulated?
We're back to mind health and body health and heart health. It's all interrelated. Absolutely.
And that kind of stimulation is on a continuum. So perhaps for Steve, it's sitting down with a good book in front of his fire. For somebody else, it might be a cultural event. It might be getting together for coffee with somebody and having a good conversation. Stimulation is important, but the stimulation needs to fit your skills and also what you care about.
Thanks so much for calling in, Steve. We're going to move to David, who's calling from Dresden. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just about to turn 65, and this has been you've interviewed some amazing people. But I do think it's important to note that race for longevity does put a huge financial strain on subsequent generations, particularly when you look at us as a country and people who, for one reason or another, don't have the means to go into a reasonably comfortable 30 or more years after retirement. So I just like to bring that up and leave it to your guests to comment on.
Sure, David. Thank you for calling. Important point, Tom.
It is. If current trends in health and longevity continue, by 2050, we may have 850,000 Americans who are centenarians. It's mind-boggling to think about that because there are roughly 55,000 in the U.S. today. And so that's a real wave. And yet there's a lot of assumptions in that, and we could probably talk for a whole show, maybe five shows, about those assumptions. Will our healthcare system be sufficient? Will retirement age need to change so that there isn't that 40-year period that the caller suggests? It's going to be really interesting to see, but I'm also curious, if I live that long, if being 100 will just become normal and not be something that you even do a show about because it's just so common.
Well, right now, about 1 in 6,000, right? So far from common yet. We'll go to Mitch calling from Durham. Hi, Mitch. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for doing this show, Jennifer. This is great. And your guests are great. Calls are great. So anyone who knows me, I've worked with the elderly a lot, both as a volunteer and then professionally as an activities director a couple of times. So I've had a lot of friends who had reached 100 and beyond, and was part of throwing a lot of birthday parties, family friends. So I've been very blessed since a kid, growing up in Franklin County, knowing a lot of people. But the two people I wanted to talk about real quick is one is Ruth Sylvester Benjamin, just passed away a couple of weeks ago. We celebrated her life this past weekend. She's 101. Years old, and she, like she threw her own 100th birthday party, made sure she had 100 guests there and all that. But the thing about Ruth was that, two things about Ruth was that she was very active throughout her life and very, very, and like the previous colleagues said, really engaged her mind a lot with reading and writing and doing things like that. The other thing is she was a procrastinator, so she always, the family always joked that she put off dying because she was such a procrastinator. But the other person who's still with us is one that I think a lot of people in Lewiston, Auburn would may or may not know is still with us, is Carol Poulin, who was Carol's music for many, many years and owned that business, and then his son took it over after until it closed. But Carol is 103 and only recently left living in his house, and it was because of a fall. And he is now in a healthcare facility, but he's still very active. His mind is great, and he's doing great. But the thing with Carol that I've always noticed is that he kept music as part of his life. He is still a season ticket holder for the Midcoast Symphony Orchestra, goes to the performances usually at the Franco Center sometimes in Topsom, is involved with going to as many musical events as he can, listens to music all the time, and makes that a really important part of his life. And as far as I know, still plays.
Mitch, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience with people you really like. Again, keeping the mind, spirit going.
Absolutely. But there's another piece to this for me, Jennifer, and that is that in our society, we have connected aging with disease, decline, and withdrawal. There are reasons for that in terms of past theories. But what's interesting is that there are older adults who actually buy into that, and they believe, oh, I'm old, you know, I'm diseased, I'm going to die early, whatever it might be. That attitude, it just infiltrates from what has come across in our society. We're at a point right now where we're really trying to reframe aging. Actually, we're doing it internationally. And that piece of having that inner belief in yourself of who you are, of being stable within yourself, of not defining yourself by your age. It's only two or three numbers. There's really nothing about those numbers that really says this is who you will be or this is what will happen to you. And so I think we really need to be careful about, as older adults, what we're buying into. And does it really fit for us? And is it true for us? And have we been enculturated to believe that aging is a bad thing? And many of us have. And I think these centenarians have gotten past that.
We have an email from Pat. As a retired geriatric nurse practitioner, I remember reading in one of my journals that we humans cannot live beyond 122 years, as the body cannot replicate cells longer than that. Has this been debunked?
I don't think so.
We're not that kind of scientist.
Yeah.
So, but if it is true that there is somebody living today who will live to 150, I think we can't be that black and white about that statement. I think we need to keep our options open and say, I think we're more interested in that health span along with lifespan and getting those two pieces together rather than really looking at cell death.
All right. We're going to go to Richard calling from Camden. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to tell a little story about growing up on Vinyl Haven. I was a teenager in the late 50s and early 60s and became aware of my great-grandmother's age. She was born in 1888, and all of a sudden I realized that I was speaking to someone who most likely knew people that were engaged in the Civil War, so it kind of compressed history for me. But every Saturday night, she would have us all over for baked beans. That was my parents, my grandparents, my three brothers, and myself. And when I got married and brought my children back to the island, she would invite them. And she lived to 101, and my children were 15 and 13 when she passed away. So they have vivid recollections of baked bean suppers, five generations sitting around the table. And really, it's what we all benefit, what we learn, what the stories we hear that people that are aged can tell us. And it really connects us to our past. And one other quick point, I have a 94-year-old neighbor, Dave Hoy, here in Camden.
that drives back to Tucson to his winter home each fall and returns to Camden in the spring. And I'm looking forward to his return in March.
Oh, wow, Richard. Well, thanks for calling in. As you were talking about him, both of our guests were nodding. Tom, you aren't surprised.
Well, you know, we all leave legacies, and oftentimes our legacies are the stories that we've shared and the good times we've shared. One of the parts that caught my attention, and really it's my story, I got into aging because I love history. And when I was studying aging in grad school, I called upon an older gentleman in my apartment complex, Gilbert, who spoke about interacting with the Civil War vets at the VFW hall. And it gives me goosebumps to say that now, because it's just, it's amazing the opportunity to learn about the past in a fresh and present way by talking to persons who are older. And that's something I encourage all younger adults to take advantage of.
Thanks, Richard, for your call. We're going to go to Priscilla, who's calling from Winthrop. Hi, Priscilla. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that my mother passed away this November at 99, and I think the idea of being 100 scared her. She had also, though, lost a comfortable enough sight to read, and reading was a big, big part of her life. So I think there is a component, you know, if you aren't doing well enough, you may have the will to stop before you get to the 100.
Marilyn's nodding.
I'm definitely nodding. And we're back to that quality of life, purpose in life, and how each person defines that. And there's nothing magical about turning 100. You know, if that's your goal, then of course go for it. But I think there's, again, they're just three numbers. The piece again is, who are we inside? What drives us? What connections do we have? How do we love? How do we live? How do we eat and exercise? And there's just so many factors that go into living a full and successful life that we just can't take one thing and say that's going to be the end-all be-all. But attitude is everything. And if that's a route that your mother chose because she couldn't read any longer because it was that important to her, then that needs to be honored, in my opinion.
You know, we all have that same endpoint of death. And I think what's more important is that we have our final weeks and days with family in a context where we feel connected and loved. Ultimately, that's what's important. The number of death doesn't matter.
All right. Well, Priscilla, thank you so much for your call, and you will be our last call for the hour. Believe it or not, we are out of time. I want to call attention to the Down East Magazine series on centenarians. Maine Public worked with Down East Magazine, and photographer Michael D. Wilson has some beautiful portraits of the people who are profiled. The editor of Down East Magazine, Brian Kevin, says that he wants Mike Wilson to get credit for being a caring and engaged and interesting guy, as well as a great photographer. Tom Muser, our guest today on the show, director of the Center for Excellence in Aging and Health and professor of social work at the University of New England. Marilyn Gallucci, president and director of geriatrics education and research with the University of New England's College of Osteopathic Medicine. Don't forget, you can find all the interviews in our Maine Public Centenarian series at mainepublic.org/century. And tune in to Here and Now Tuesday and Wednesday to hear more stories from that series as well. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as all sorts of helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.